Les colloques du Collège de France.
Bien, nous voici arrivés à la dernière session de la journée qui a pour titre « Justice et vérité du génocide, passé qui ne passe pas et assassin de la mémoire ». Et cette dernière partie, bien entendu, nous amène dans le présent le plus immédiat, puisque les deux intervenants vont traiter de l'écrasement de Gaza et de ses habitants, qui est, je crois, fallacieusement appelé dans les médias « guerre Israël-Hamas ». Le titre de la session reprend une double citation que vous aurez certainement identifiée, d'Éric Conan et Henri Rousseau, « Un passé qui ne passe pas », sur la présence de Vichy dans la société française, et Pierre Vidal-Naquet, Les assassins de la mémoire, sur les négationnistes de la Shoah. Alors nous avons donc à nouveau deux intervenants de deux disciplines différentes, un historien et une juriste, qui va nous permettre de poursuivre cette conversation engagée depuis ce matin entre le droit et l'histoire. Alors, je suis particulièrement sensible à l'invitation qui a été faite à Omer Bartoff pour notre réflexion sur la situation actuelle dans les territoires palestiniens occupés. Il a en effet joué un rôle très important dans la qualification de ce qui se joue en ce moment à Gaza. Historien, il a été formé à l'université de Tel Aviv. Il est aujourd'hui professeur à l'université de Brown, où sa chaire porte sur les études des génocides et notamment de la Shoah, Holocauste en anglais, ce qui en fait un expert internationalement reconnu sur notre thème. Ses premiers travaux portaient sur un aspect particulier, et notamment de la Seconde Guerre mondiale, et notamment l'endoctrinement des soldats de la Wehrmacht et les crimes qu'ils ont perpétrés. C'est notamment le livre « The Eastern Front, 1941-1945 », donc le front de l'Est, de 1941 à 1945, et « Hitler's Army, Soldiers, Nazis and War in the Third Reich », l'armée d'Hitler, les soldats, les nazis et la guerre sous le Troisième Reich. Et puis il s'est ensuite intéressé, et se rapprochant de notre thème, au lien entre guerre totale et génocide dans ses livres « Murder in our midst, Mirrors of Destruction » et le meurtre en notre sein, « Miroir de la destruction » et « Germany's War and the Holocaust », qu'on traduirait plutôt en français, par « La guerre de l'Allemagne et la Shoah ». Je ne citerai pas la totalité de ces livres, la liste est longue, mais il me semble important de mentionner deux un peu plus récents, « Erased, Vanishing Traces of Jewish Galicia in Present-day Ukraine », donc « Effacer les traces évanouies des juifs de la Galice dans l'Ukraine d'aujourd'hui », et « Tales from the Borderlands, Making and Unmaking the Galician Past », donc les contes ou les récits plutôt des territoires frontaliers, faire et défaire le passé de Galiciens. Et c'est sur la disparition programmée de la mémoire des Juifs d'Ukraine. Il a reçu de nombreux prix et de nombreuses distinctions que je ne vais pas lister. Et je voudrais simplement terminer en disant que après une première intervention qui avait été prudente, à l'automne 2023 dans le New York Times, au cours de laquelle il alertait sur le risque d'un génocide en train d'être commis à Gaza. Il en a ensuite établi la réalité effective, notamment après un séjour en Israël. Et sa voix a été très importante, y compris dans un article courageux dans la New York Review of Books. Donc, sa conférence aujourd'hui a pour titre « Eradicating Gaza, How to Remember and Forget Genocide », donc « Éradiquer Gaza, comment se souvenir et oublier le génocide ». Et on m'a demandé que je dise quelques mots, puisque l'exposé sera en anglais, que je dise quelques mots après son exposé pour en résumer quelques points.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Je m'excuse que je vais parler en anglais. Just before I begin, first, this session is dedicated to the another elephant in the room, which is what's happening in Gaza at the moment. And I just want to draw your attention to an article that came out in Hebrew 2 days ago, but I just saw that it came out in English as well in Haaretz, in the English version of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, which provides the most updated information on the eradication of Gaza. So the map that you're seeing here does not reflect the extent of the eradication, and I just got it now, so I couldn't put it up there, but you will be able to find it easily. So just about a month after the Hamas attack of October 7th, 2023, on Israel, I wrote, as was just mentioned by Didier, in the New York Times, that there was already sufficient evidence that the Israeli army had committed war crimes and potentially crimes against humanity in its massive assault on Gaza. While blood-curdling statements by Israeli political leaders and army generals clearly expressed genocidal intent, I concluded at the time that what was happening was not genocide, but I wanted to warn of a potential genocide before it occurred rather than condemning it afterward. And of course, this is what we've been talking about here all day. I'd also hoped to influence American policymakers to force Israeli leaders to come to their senses. But President Biden, at the time, did not put his foot down, which he could have easily done. We can talk about that later. In May 2024, he announced a plan, said to have been supported by Israel, to have all the hostages released and end the war. Instead, the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, ordered close to 1 million Palestinians sheltering in Rafah, which is the southernmost city in the Gaza Strip, in the Blue Strip, most of whom had already been displaced multiple times, to move to the beach area, the Al-Mawasi, which is just along the beach of the southwestern tip of the Gaza Strip. This is the Mediterranean, what you see in dark color. He ordered them to move there without any humanitarian infrastructure. The army then proceeded to flatten Rafah, a feat largely accomplished by July, and now there's nothing left of that city. It says here that it housed about 250, probably the number is more like 270,000. It's about the same population as that of the city of Haifa, those of you who may have been to Israel. At that point, it appeared to me no longer possible to deny that the pattern of IDF operations was consistent with those statements made by Israeli leaders earlier. On October 7th, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu promised that Gazans would pay a, quote, huge price, that the IDF would turn parts of Gaza, quote, into rubble. And later he urged Israelis to, quote, remember what Amalek did to you, in retaliation to which, as most Israelis know, the Bible demands, quote, kill alike men and women, infants and sucklings. Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich clarified, the work must be completed, total destruction, blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. On October 9th, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant at the time stated, quote, we are fighting human animals and we're acting accordingly. It was just mentioned, dehumanization of the other side. The next day, Major General Hassan Alian addressed Gazans, he's a Druze general in the Israeli army, in Arabic, quote, human animals must be treated as such. There will be no electricity and no water. There will only be destruction. You wanted hell, you will get hell. And retired Major General Giora Island, who is a very influential voice on the Israeli media then and now, called for Gaza, quote, to become a place where no human being can exist. actions on the ground could only be understood as the implementation of this clearly expressed intent to make the Gaza Strip uninhabitable for its Palestinian population. The goal was, and is, to force the population to leave the Strip altogether, or, considering that it has nowhere to go, to debilitate it through bombings and severe deprivation of food, clean water, sanitation, and medical aid to such an extent that it would be impossible for Palestinians in Gaza to maintain or reconstitute their existence as a group. My inescapable conclusion, further strengthened since May 2024, was that Israel was committing genocide against the Palestinians. Now, the crime of genocide, you've heard that several times today, was defined in 1948 by the United Nations as, quote, the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such. In determining genocide, therefore, we must both establish intent and show that it is being implemented. That intent was expressed, as I noted, by numerous figures in Israel right after October 7th. But intent can also be derived from a pattern of operations on the ground. And it was this pattern that had become clear to me by May 2024, and that had since become even clearer, as the IDF systematically destroyed the Gaza Strip with the goal of making it unlivable for its Palestinian population and thereby eradicating its existence as a national and ethnic group. The systematic destruction not only of housing, but of public buildings, hospitals, universities, schools, mosques, museums, as well as water plants, agricultural areas, parks, literally everything, reflects a policy aimed at making the revival of Palestinian life in the future highly unlikely. According to recent estimates, and those you can look up now, also in Haaretz, and they are quite reliable, and they're based on a whole lot of information that I can't articulate right now, 174,000 buildings have been destroyed, completely destroyed or damaged, making up 70% of all built-up structures in the Strip. As of June 8th, 2025, that is a couple of weeks ago, almost 55,000 people had been killed, 70% of them children, including 70% of them civilians, including close to 17,000 children, who make up a third of the total count. Almost 1,000 of the child victims were younger than 1 year old. An additional 10,000 people are assumed to be buried under the ruins of their homes, and nobody really knows how many, it's an estimate. More than 125,000 have been wounded and maimed. Gaza has gained the notorious distinction of having the highest number of amputee children per capita in the world. Untold additional thousands of chronically ill persons have died for lack of access to hospital care. An entire generation of children subjected to ongoing military attacks, loss of parents, and long-term malnutrition will suffer from severe physical and mental repercussions for the rest of their lives. The horror of what has been happening in Gaza is still described by most observers as a war. But this is a cynical misnomer. Since June 2024, the IDF has not been fighting against an organized military body. As such, Hamas has been destroyed, although it retains control over the population in areas not held by the Israeli army. Instead, the IDF is engaged in an operation of demolition and ethnic cleansing, as Mr. Netanyahu's own former chief of staff and minister of defense, the hardline Moshe Bogi Yaalon, described the attempt to clear the northern Gaza Strip of its population and flatten it entirely already in December last year, So if you look at this map, I know it's in Hebrew, the red corridor you see there is called the Netzarim corridor. That's what it says there. All the area north of that, which includes the city of Gaza, the city of Jabalia, and the refugee camp of Jabalia, has been largely destroyed. The refugee camp of Jabalia and Shuja'iyah, which is another refugee camp, are flattened. There's nothing there. You can see it in aerial photographs. I'm just fine where I was. Yes. So this was described already in December 2024 by Moshe Bogi Yaalon, whom I've known for 50 years, and who is very right-wing, as ethnic cleansing on Israeli TV, shocking the woman who was speaking with them on TV. Following Israel's unilateral decision in March this year to break the ceasefire that had existed, that was forced on Israel in January by President Trump, of all people, the IDF is executing a well-publicized plan to concentrate the entire population of Gaza in a quarter of the territory of the Strip's southwestern edge, and to literally demolish, using vast numbers of bulldozers newly supplied by the United States, as well as huge aerial bombs, similarly made in America, to destroy every remaining structure and establish military control over the other 75% of the demographically cleansed territory. So the 2 million population, the population of 2 million people are supposed to be concentrated in that area on the southwestern edge of Gaza. Now, ethnic cleansing can be defined as the attempt by one ethnic group or national group to remove another ethnic group from a territory it wants for itself. But when that ethnic group has nowhere to go and is constantly displaced from one so-called safe zone to another, being relentlessly bombed, starved, and decimated, ethnic cleansing becomes genocide, as was the case in several well-known genocides of the 20th century, such as that of the Herero in German Southwest Africa in 1904, now Namibia, the genocide of the Armenians in 1915, and indeed the Holocaust, which began with the German attempt to expel the Jews and ended up with a murder when it turned out they had nowhere to go. In November 2023, in that article I wrote at the time, I called also on leaders and senior scholars of institutions dedicated to researching and commemorating the Holocaust to publicly warn against the rage and vengeance-filled rhetoric that dehumanizes the population of Gaza and calls for its extinction. I'm citing myself here, that article. I urge the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington and Yad Vashem, the Memorial and Research Institute in Jerusalem, to, quote, step in now and stand at the forefront of those warning against war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, and the crime of all crimes, genocide. But to this day, with a few courageous exceptions, few scholars of the Holocaust and no institution dedicated to researching and commemorating it have responded to this call. The silence has made a mockery of the slogan, "Never Again," transforming its meaning from an assertion of resistance to inhumanity, wherever it is perpetrated, even by Israel, to an excuse, an apology, indeed even a carte blanche for destroying others by invoking one's own past victimhood. This is one of the many incalculable costs of the current catastrophe unfolding in front of our eyes. As Israel is literally trying to wipe out Palestinian existence as a national group in Gaza and is exercising increasing violence against Palestinians in the West Bank under cover of the international focus on Gaza with the same intent, the moral and historical credit on which the Jewish state has drawn until now is running out. Israel, created in the wake of the Holocaust as the answer to the Nazi genocide of the Jews, has always insisted that any threat to its security must be seen as potentially leading to another Auschwitz. This provides Israel with license to portray those it perceives as its enemies as Nazis, a term currently being used by the Israeli media on a daily basis to depict Hamas, and by extension, all Gazans, based on the popular assertion that none of them is uninvolved, not even the babies who would grow up to be militants. Hence, the entire population must be uprooted and removed. Israel has been conducting its annihilatory operation in Gaza for the last 20 months under the guise of preventing another Holocaust with impunity. The daily scenes of horror from which the Israeli public is shielded by its own media's self-censorship, you can't see any of these scenes on Israeli TV, expose the lies disseminated by Israeli propaganda that this is a war of defense against a Nazi-like enemy, and make one shudder when Israeli spokespersons still shamelessly utter the hollow slogan of the IDF being the most moral army in the world. What will the impact of losing this invaluable credit line of the perpetual stance of the victim state fighting remorselessly for its bare existence? And that's what I want to talk about in the rest of this talk. How will Israel's future be affected by the inevitable demolition of its incontestable morality derived from its birth in the ashes of the Holocaust, thanks to its own murderous actions? And what consequences will this inconceivable moral reversal have for the entire culture of Holocaust commemoration, the politics of memory, education, and scholarship, whose intellectual and administrative leaders have up to now adamantly refused to face up to their responsibility to denounce inhumanity and genocide wherever they occur, instead of taking shelter behind slogans that these leaders' very silence has emptied of meaning? As a sovereign state, Israel's political leadership and its citizenry will have to choose their own path. Since there does not seem to be sufficient domestic pressure for the urgently needed profound change of paradigm from war and violence to a politics of compromise and reconciliation, and since robust external pressure from the country's allies appears unlikely, I suspect that Israel will persist on the current disastrous course, remaking itself, perhaps irretrievably, into a full-blown authoritarian apartheid state. Such states, as history has taught us, do not last a long time. As for those engaged in the worldwide culture of commemoration and remembrance built around the Holocaust, especially since the 1980s, they will have to confront a major moral reckoning. Unlike the majority of Holocaust scholars and institutions, the community of genocide scholars, those engaged in the study of comparative genocide or of any one of the many other genocides that have marred human history, are now edging ever closer to a consensus over describing events in Gaza as genocide. For many of these researchers, this was not an easy conclusion to reach, both because of the complexity of the events and for lack of objective reporting, as well as because of the inherent costs of naming Israel a state guilty of genocide. For instance, in November 2023, genocide scholar Ernesto Verdeja described Israel's actions in Gaza as moving toward a, quote, genocidal campaign. But Ben Kiernan, a former director of the Cambodian genocide program at Yale University, who is Australian originally, thought that, quote, however indiscriminate and despite the numerous civilian casualties, the IDF's bombing campaign and ground attack did not yet meet the very high threshold that is required to meet the legal definition of genocide. But as things in Gaza got progressively worse, more and more genocide scholars weighed in. In June 2024, the former executive director of Human Rights Watch, Arye Naier, stated in no uncertain terms that as a result of Israel's, quote, sustained policy of obstructing the movement of humanitarian assistance into the territory, end of quote, he had become, again I'm quoting, persuaded that Israel is engaged in genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, end of quote. By November, the Israeli genocide scholar Shmuel Lederman joined the growing chorus of opinion that Israel was engaged in genocidal actions. Our own honored guest here, William Shabbos, came to the same conclusion last year and recently described Israel's campaign in Gaza as absolutely a genocide. Other genocide experts, such as Melanie O'Brien, president of the International Association of Genocide Scholars, and British specialist Martin Shaw, have reached the same conclusion. And another scholar whose name was evoked here earlier, Australian scholar Dirk Moses of the City University of New York, describes these events as a mix of genocidal and military logic. No wonder that in May last month, Ugur Emet Enger, a researcher at the Institute for War, Holocaust, and Genocide Studies in Amsterdam, who wrote a fantastic book on Syria, stated that he could not name anyone, quote, whose work I respect, who does not think it is genocide. Now, this is not the view of most Holocaust scholars. With a few notable exceptions, such as the Israeli Raz Segal, program director of genocide studies at Stockton University in the United States, and Hebrew University historians Amos Goldberg and Daniel Blattman, the majority of academics engaged with the history of the Nazi genocide of the Jews have stayed remarkably silent, while some have openly denied the crimes in Gaza or accused their more critical colleagues of incendiary speech, wild exaggeration, well-poisoning, and anti-Semitism. Soon after my own November 2023 essay in The Times, an opinion piece published in the English edition of Haaretz by several leading Israeli and American Holocaust scholars described my warning of an imminent genocide as, quote, inflammatory and dangerous, insisting that there was, quote, no evidence that Israel is engaged in ethnic cleansing, war crimes, crimes against humanity, or has genocidal intentions. And we can see where that led. In December 2024, Holocaust scholar Norman Golda opined that, quote, genocide charges like this have long been used as a fig leaf for broader challenges to Israel's legitimacy. And he expressed his worry that, quote, they have cheapened the gravity of the word genocide itself. In February 2025, in another essay, Golda argued that, quote, while Israel, unlike other states, has been charged with genocide throughout its existence, the IDF operation in Gaza has caused not only a rush to judgment, but an effort to redefine genocide itself. This genocide libel, that's the term that he used, deploys, I'm quoting, a range of anti-Semitic tropes, including the coupling of the genocide charge with the deliberate killing of children, images of whom are ubiquitous on NGO, social media, and other platforms, and charge Israel with genocide. So in other words, showing images of Palestinian children ripped apart by US-made bombs launched by Israeli pilots is, in Godot's view, an anti-Semitic act. Most recently, Goda and another respected historian, and a very good historian, Jeffrey Herf, penned an opinion piece in the Washington Post, I think came out last week or 2 weeks ago. where they stated that, quote, the genocide accusation hurled against Israel draws on deep wells of fear and hatred that lurk in radical interpretations of both Christianity and Islam, and has shifted the opprobrium from Jews as a religious ethnic group to the state of Israel, which it depicts as inherently evil. The article casts doubt on the veracity of the human catastrophe in Gaza, and then goes on to say no one has an accurate figure of how many people have died in this war, and they suggest that we, quote, should give weight to the assertions of the government of Israel, which actually has given no estimates whatsoever of losses of civilians or anyone in Gaza. What might be the ramifications of this rift between the community of genocide scholars and that of Holocaust historians, with the latter implying that the former are motivated by anti-Semitism? Now, this is not merely a squabble within academe, I would argue. The memory culture created in recent decades around the Holocaust encompasses much more than the genocide of the Jews. It has come to play a crucial role in politics, education, and identity. Museums dedicated to the Holocaust have served as models for representations of other genocides around the world. Insistence that the lessons of the Holocaust demand the promotion of tolerance, diversity, anti-racism, and support for migrants and refugees, not to say human rights and international humanitarian law, is rooted in an understanding of the universal implications of this crime in the heart of Western civilization at the peak of modernity. Calling a certain event genocide has major political as well as legal and moral ramifications. Nations, politicians, and military personnel suspected, indicted, or found guilty of genocide are seen as beyond the pale of humanity and lose the right to remain members of the international community. And a society that condones and is complicit in genocide, whatever the stand of its individual citizens may be, will carry this mark of Cain long after the fires of hatred and violence are put out. This implies that discrediting genocide scholars who call out Israel's genocide in Gaza as anti-Semitic threatens to undermine everything that genocide studies stands for, namely the ongoing need to define, prevent, punish, and reconstruct the history of genocide. Suggesting that this endeavor is motivated by malign interests and sentiments, indeed that it is driven by the very hatred and prejudice that was at the root of the Holocaust, is not only morally scandalous, but also provides an opening for a politics of impunity and denialism, now unfortunately supported by the US sanctioning of the ICC, once again providing Israeli leaders with impunity. By the same token, those who have dedicated their careers to teaching and commemorating the Holocaust when those who have dedicated their careers to teaching and commemorating the Holocaust insist on ignoring or denying Israel's genocidal actions in Gaza, they threaten to undermine everything that Holocaust scholarship and commemoration has stood for in the last several decades: human rights, the dignity of every human being, respect for the rule of law, and the urgent need never to let inhumanity take over the hearts of people and steer the actions of nations in the name of security, national interests, and sheer vengeance. What I fear is that in the aftermath of the Gaza genocide, it will no longer be possible to continue teaching and researching the Holocaust in the same manner we did before. Because the Holocaust has been so relentlessly invoked by the State of Israel and its defenders as a cover-up for the crimes of the IDF, the study and remembrance of the Holocaust will lose its claim to be concerned with universal justice. and retreat into the same ethnic ghetto in which it began its life at the end of the war as a marginalized preoccupation by the remnants of a marginalized people, before it succeeded decades later to find its rightful place as a lesson and a warning for humanity as a whole. Just as worrisome is the prospect that the study of genocide will not survive the accusations of anti-Semitism, leaving us without the crucial community of scholars and international jurists to stand in the breach at a time of rising intolerance, racial hatred, populism, and authoritarianism that is threatening the very values that were the core of these scholarly, cultural, and political endeavors. Perhaps the only light, and I'll end here on an optimistic note, perhaps the only light at the end of this very dark tunnel is the possibility that having exhausted the line of credit that allowed Israel to get away with so much violence, a new generation of Israelis will face their future without sheltering in the shadow of the Holocaust, even as they will have to bear the stain of the genocide in Gaza perpetrated in their name. Israel will have to learn to live without falling back on the Holocaust as justification for inhumanity. That, despite all the horrific suffering we are currently watching, is a good thing, and may in the long run help Israel face up to the future in a healthier, more rational, and less fearful and violent manner. This will do nothing to compensate for the massive death and suffering of Palestinians. But an Israel liberated from the overwhelming burden of the Holocaust may finally come to terms with the inescapable need for its 7 million Jewish citizens to share the land with the 7 million Palestinians under its rule in peace, equality, and dignity for all. That will be the only just reckoning with the genocidal past of these two peoples. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup. Je pense que beaucoup d'entre vous ont compris les propos d'Omer Bartov, mais pour celles et ceux qui auraient suivi plus difficilement, comme on l'a dit tout à l'heure, juste quelques mots de synthèse de son propos. Il a commencé à parler de l'alerte qu'il avait lancée à l'automne 2023, qui était destinée à la fois à Israël, aux autorités israéliennes, et aussi aux autorités états-uniennes, et notamment au président des États-Unis, sur le risque d'un génocide. Et il a notamment ensuite énuméré les éléments qui attestaient l'intention, avec tout un ensemble de citations de hauts responsables politiques et militaires israéliens, et la mise en œuvre de cette intention sur le terrain par l'armée. À cet égard, pour ceux qui souhaiteraient avoir des éléments extrêmement précis sur ces citations et ces faits, il y a un travail qui a été réalisé par l'historien israélien Lee Mordechai, qui est mis à jour régulièrement et qui établit véritablement, factuellement, des éléments sur ce qui se passe à Gaza et en Israël. Il a ensuite souligné le projet de rendre invivable Gaza et non seulement d'éradiquer un peuple, mais d'éradiquer son futur. Je cite ces mots, et son futur aussi bien sur le plan culturel par la destruction des musées, des universités, etc., des écoles, mais également à travers les enfants, par à la fois les processus de malnutrition, de traumatisme, d'amputation, de perte des parents, etc., qui oblitère le futur. Et puis, il a évoqué l'appel qu'il avait adressé aux spécialistes et aux institutions qui prennent en charge les questions de génocide et notamment de la Shoah. Et il n'a pas été entendu. Et si je peux me permettre, je crois qu'il a même démissionné du comité éditorial de Yad Vashem Studies. Il a démissionné. Justement parce qu'il n'y avait pas d'écho à sa demande. Il a ensuite réfléchi sur la question du futur d'Israël, à la fois comme société dont très peu se sont élevés contre ce qui se passait, et donc qu'est-ce que ça signifie pour ce qui est à venir, mais également du point de vue de l'État, un État qu'il a qualifié d'autoritaire et d'apartheid, dont il dit que l'histoire nous montre que ça ne tient pas dans la durée. Et enfin, les enjeux moraux qu'Israël et les Israéliens ne pourront pas manquer un jour de devoir confronter. Il a montré qu'il y avait quelques voix qui s'exprimaient parmi les experts des génocides sur ces questions et en analysant et en dénonçant l'existence d'un génocide, mais souligne que la majorité sont soit silencieux, soit se montre extrêmement critique, voire agressif, accusant ceux qui, comme lui, posent ces termes d'antisémitisme. Et dès lors, la question qui se pose pour lui, c'est comment sera-t-il encore possible d'enseigner les études sur les génocides et d'enseigner l'histoire de la Shoah dès lors qu'elle aura été utilisée de manière aussi instrumentale pour justifier la guerre et les massacres à Gaza. Dès lors, la Shoah retomberait, ce sont ces termes, dans un ghetto ethnique en renonçant à ce qui était en principe son projet universaliste de dénonciation des violences extrêmes. Et puis, il termine par une petite note optimiste en parlant de la seule lumière qu'il peut voir au bout de ce tunnel qu'il vient de décrire, c'est qu'il y ait un jour une nouvelle génération d'Israéliens qui n'ait plus envie d'utiliser la Shoah de cette manière et qui au contraire se réfère à un futur dans lequel il serait possible pour des Israéliens et des Palestiniens de vivre en paix, en justice et en égalité.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.